We all have a story. Sometimes it's a story we choose, and sometimes it's a story we fall into. That choice can either work for us or against us. Now, according to experts Gallup, on average, we spend 81,396 hours at work over the course of our lifetime. In fact, the only thing we spend more time doing than working is sleeping. And yet, as Gallup's research shows, only around 1 in 10 people in the UK truly love the work they do. And that's the reason for this podcast. To help the 9 out of 10 of us who dread the thought of weekday mornings, I remember myself how that felt before I changed my own career story. My name's Carolyn Parry, and I'm an award-winning career coach and speaker who spent the first 17 years of my career working in business, heading steadfastly away from who I really was. It took a dose of burnout and a lot of time in what I still fondly call the Rodin pose, thinking about what I wanted before I was able to escape from a job I hated and create a career I still love as much today as I did when I first started 20 years ago. So, if you're like I was and the thought of weekday mornings fills you with dread, or that quiet voice inside you keeps telling you that there is definitely something better waiting for you, why not join me in a conversation with an inspirational guest about how they have successfully changed their career story. Full of ideas, strategies and insights drawn from those real life stories, the Change Your Story podcast will help you to discover your why and what else really matters to you, so you too can create a working life you love. Welcome to Change Your Story. It's my absolute pleasure to welcome Lorna Collins to this episode of Change Your Story. Lorna, a very warm welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So these days, Lorna's known as a neurodiverse artist, a filmmaker, a writer, journalist, an arts educator. She's a polymath and a former academic with a Master of Philosophy in European Literature and Culture, a PhD in Art and Aesthetics in Contemporary French from Cambridge, a second Master's this time in Fine Art from Anglia Ruskin University. She's a Fellow of the Higher Education Academy of the Royal Society of Public Health. But none of that was her original plan. Achieving all of this would be remarkable for most people, and achieving it against the backdrop of a riding accident that almost killed her and left her with severe brain damage and the consequences in the mental health space that come from an event like that. Lorna's is a story of enforced reinvention. Above all, it's her quest for authentic authenticity, happiness, and true expression of self and her emotions through the work she does and using the energy-giving and healing power of creativity. So, Lorna, let's go right back to the start. Where did you grow up?
Well, that's quite hard to describe, really, because I know it. I know an awful lot about myself and my upbringing because I've learnt what happened and I've been told what happened, but I don't remember it. But we might come back to that a little bit later. But I do know I was brought up on an idyllic farm in the Chiltern Hills in southern England. And I used to go and crawl out into the stables when I was a toddler and couldn't walk and sit in the stables and talk to the horses. And the horses and the animals were all my friends. And I was a happy-go-lucky child.
So that lovely picture of animals and horses, I have to say that resonates. My own daughter is absolutely horse mad and was from a very early age. Now, your love of horses took you on far, didn't it? You already had a plan as you were growing up and you went on to quite some substantial success with horses, even as an early age teenager.
Yes, I could ride and I was put on a pony before I could walk. So as a baby, I was plonked on a pony and I just used to wander along and I was very happy. I also took it extremely seriously. So I had high aims. I wanted to win the Olympics. I wanted to be the first lady jockey to win the Grand National. I first represented Great Britain on a horse when I was 13. When I was 16, I went to the Junior European Championships in eventing. And I was placed 15th out of the whole of Europe. I guess that sounds quite impressive.
It is, as somebody who's got a daughter that rides. I know eventing is not for the faint-hearted, having watched people come down those great big steps. That's not for the faint-hearted. That takes some courage and some grit and some hard work, doesn't it?
Yeah, I used to ride before I went to school and after I went to school. Apparently, I used to ride instead of doing games. So I got out of doing games because I was hopeless. So all the sort of netball and football or whatever they play. I can't even remember what we used to play. But I was terrible at everything else apart from riding. Although, actually, I was quite good at academic stuff. You know, I was quite hardworking. So I guess I had a lot of pressure on me in different spheres. But I was determined to do my best.
And your best obviously clearly came out in that GB eventing success. And you were also pursuing another horse-related passion at the same time, weren't you? You've talked about the Grand National. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, my dad was a champion jockey and he won this race, which is in Czechoslovakia or in the Czech Republic, called the Pardubice. And it's the most difficult, hardest, longest race in the entire world. Now, he won it once and the next year he went back and fell off his horse twice, but got back on and was third.
Wow.
Which is extraordinary. So this is what I was living up to. And I was really passionate about racing. So I became a jockey when I was 16. And I rode in point-to-point races, which is basically for amateur jockeys. And I used to ride out on the racehorses. Like Henrietta Knight is a brilliant trainer. I used to ride out for her and all these other like really great, significant people in the field of racing. And I absolutely loved going really fast and doing really reckless things on a horse. And I was desperate to win all the races.
Interesting. What I'm already hearing, apart from the discipline we've already talked about, is this sense of preparation for a hard race and keeping going. And if there was ever anything that we might use to describe your life as a whole, it's that hard race, isn't it? And that spirit of excellence and desire to be the best and that quest for success. Now, sometimes what we love can kill us. That's almost what happened to you, wasn't it, with Paul the racehorse?
Paul was my racehorse. I don't remember anything about Paul, actually. It's a bit of an abstract concept, Paul. But apparently I was very fond of him and I was racing him and I was one day on a gallop, so a stretch of grass, to do some training for the races. And my dad was there and Paul was wearing bandages on his legs to protect him. And one of the bandages came off, the Velcro wasn't done up properly, and he tripped on the loose piece of bandage and we had a rotational fall. So he toppled over and went over backwards and I fell off and landed right on my head. And I'm once again, just to remind everyone, I don't remember any of this. This is what I've been told happened. Anyway, so I was on the floor and I wasn't breathing. I was kind of, you know, not really there anymore. And my dad came over and he gave me the kiss of life. He breathed life back into me because I'd stopped breathing and I was basically dead, you know. Anyway, he gave me the kiss of life and called the ambulance and they airlifted me to hospital. And I was in a coma. I had severe brain damage to different parts of my brain. And this area, this sort of part of my life is not there. According to me, it didn't happen. Because my whole life is blurred around this point. You know, I have no memory before or after, or that whole area of time is gone. But apparently when I was in a coma, my mother would come to the hospital and she made a recording of all the horses and the dogs and the chickens making sounds on the farm. So I heard the sound of the farm. And apparently I would smile when she played it to me. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
We've talked about death just now, or near death just now, and they say that hearing is the last sense to go. With dementia patients, sound can transform them into a different place, particularly through music. So I'm not surprised that the sound of the animals actually gave you a sense of connection and maybe brought you back a little bit, gave you that sense of something coming back, and obviously did that for your parents, who no doubt were going through hell themselves in that experience. So a period that's missing from your life, and yet you're a youngster, young teenager still. You talk in your TEDx talk about, and the links will be in the show notes, you talk about the accident leaving you with amnesia and a loss of identity. Do you think that those qualities that you gain from riding a horse at speed, the courage, the bravery, the desire to achieve, they clearly have stayed with you all the way through, haven't they?
You know what? I think I've turned in a full circle. So I think a lot of things went away from me and I became a different person. My identity changed, my personality changed. And I was so lost and confused. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know who anyone was. And my mind reacting to the brain injury, as we will go on to discuss, it was huge problems with relationships, with being social, with personal identity crisis, you know. So I think I did definitely change. And any sort of courage, the forceful nature inside me to ride a horse, I guess, that was all turned against me, inwards and against me. So I would be trying to destroy myself rather than using it as a powerful energy moving forwards to do something positive, it was pushed somehow against me, internally directed to destroy me. So in a complex way, yes, perhaps I continued the same, but the forces were all messed up, mixed up, pushed in the wrong direction, and I was completely lost for many years.
And yet you still kept going. You did your A-levels, albeit a bit late. You were trying to pick up the original dream you had of going to Cambridge at that point, weren't you?
Well, yeah, before my head injury, I had a place at Cambridge with a provisional offer. And I hadn't done my A-levels. But after my brain injury, I went back to school and had help to teach myself the syllabus again, which I forgot because of the amnesia. I had total amnesia, so I forgot everything I'd learned. So I had to learn the whole syllabus again. And I took A-levels a year late, still very unwell, very, very unwell. I could hardly stay awake during the exams. I was really not there. But I got ABB in the end. I didn't have the capacity to go to university. So I was unwell. I was in hospital most of the time for many, many years after the head injury. I came out of hospital to do my A-levels. And then for the brain injury hospital, sort of physical problem hospital. And then I developed a number of different psychiatric illnesses as my mind reacted to the brain injury.
And processed its way through. Interesting. Just going back to A-levels for a minute, it's not that I'm obsessed with A-levels, but quite often that's a significant moment that contains the seeds of something later on. Given you had some amnesia around that period, I hope I'm not asking a silly question by saying, do you remember what subjects you did at A-level now?
Well, you know what? Actually, I haven't told you this before, but I found a letter I wrote to, I don't know who I wrote it to, saying that I chose my A-levels that I did. I've just remembered now, I did history of art and classics, classical civilization, and I chose those. I did history, apparently I was good at history for some reason, but I chose the other two because they were the easiest ones to do. And I was given advice that if I did easy A-levels, I'd be more likely to get an A, so then I could go to Oxford or Cambridge more easily. So that's the only reason I did them.
Interesting.
So, I mean, later on, I developed a passion for art and creativity and writing. When I was choosing my A-levels, I chose the ones I was most likely to get an A in for no other reason.
And yet they became a passion, or at least one of them did. And we'll explore that a little bit further on.
So sorry to ruin that thread.
No, it's your story. You need to tell your story the way it is for you. It's your truth we're exploring today. And that's the important thing. We all have our own sense of truth and reality. And that is our truth and our right to have that. So absolutely no need to apologise about destroying a thread at all. You did manage to get to university though, didn't you?
Yes. So my brain injury was in the year 2000 and I was then in hospital. We might come back to this, but I was basically detained in compulsory admissions to hospital, mental health asylums for many years. And I kept going in and out of hospitals because I had problems that were never resolved and I had never had any proper treatment. And I was all like, no one understood that it was the result of the brain injury. They just thought I was, just weird. Anyway, no one understood me. The point is, I got to the year 2006 or 7 and I realized if I was ever going to do anything with my life, I needed to have an education. Because I couldn't get a job just having A-levels. I realised I needed to go to university. So I didn't know how I was going to do that because I was in hospital at the time. But I went online and I found a course that looked really interesting at Greenwich University. It was Media Arts Philosophy, I think it's called that. So I contacted the head of the course and they invited me to go down to the university for a chat. And I went to speak to the course leader, Johnny Golding, who became an incredibly important figure in my early career and is now a professor, I think, at the Royal Academy or the Royal College of Art or somewhere like that. Anyway, she thought I was really interesting because of my story and all that. And she said, right, you can come and do the master's here. But hang on, you haven't got an undergraduate degree. So basically, I went to Greenwich and I did the undergraduate degree, which was in, I can't even remember what it was in, media, culture, communication or something really random. And I did that in a year, the whole degree in a year.
As you do.
And then I did the master's at the same time, but I couldn't graduate for the master's because I hadn't got the undergraduate degree. So I just got an honorary master's. And then when I was doing my dissertation as an undergraduate, this lovely lady, Johnny, she said to me, really, you shouldn't be here. You should go to Oxford or Cambridge to do a master's. You should go somewhere really proper. And I'm like, why? This is bizarre. And she's like, you have an extraordinary mind or something like that. I'm not making it up. She actually said that. And then I thought, oh, well, you know, got nothing to lose. I may as well give it a go. So I put in some kind of application in. I did it in a week. And at Cambridge, they really like different people who think differently. They're looking for oddballs, you know. So they, and to my surprise, they gave me an interview. I went to the interview in the language department at Cambridge to interview for the degree in the Master of Philosophy in European Literature and Culture, specializing in French. At the interview, they gave me a test in French to see if I could speak and write French. And I failed the test because I couldn't speak or write or read French. But they thought I was really interesting. You know, I had this massive theory about schizophrenia and psychosis and, you know, thinking after a head injury, the brain, you know, neurology and thought and matter, the difference between mind and matter. They were blown away. They're like, God, who is this woman? You know. Anyway, I said to them, right. Well, I said it a bit more seriously than this, but I said, if you accept me, I will learn French in an instant. And so they gave me an offer.
So the extraordinary mind enabled you to learn French really quickly.
I did then go to France and learn French. But the thing that taught me French, really, was just reading. I bought all the books on the list, on the reading list, in French. It's quite hard to buy them in England, but you can go and buy them in France. Loads of bookshops in Paris, you know, it's amazing. So I bought all the books and I just read the books, you know. That taught me French. Still couldn't speak that well, but it's really reading that you need to learn. Because French, I used to be thinking that really the reason why I wanted to study at Cambridge and this degree and in the French department was French philosophy, you know, was because the thinkers in French get closer to truth than the thinkers in English.
So people like Sartre,
yeah,
the existentialists, Theatre of the Absurd.
My favourite was a French philosopher who people don't, normal people, as in people who normally, like, I guess, what is normal? That's another thing in itself. Most people don't know him, but Gilles Deleuze. And he wrote a book called Logique de la Sensation. It's a book about Francis Bacon, the logic of sensation. And that, oh, you get me started. Don't get me started. I could go on for hours. Anyway, it's a really good book, philosophically. It really challenges what Plato was saying, you know. Ultimately, the true nature of the problem of humanity is dialectic thought, which is dividing reality into opposites, yes, no, good, bad, black, white. And Gilles Deleuze, in my opinion, is the only way to get past that point because he engages with art.
How interesting. He also engages in grey and different understandings, which for somebody with the brain injury you've had will obviously resonate far better than black and white because you don't see the world in black and white in that way, do you?
Exactly.
So you went on and got a scholarship to do a PhD.
So I studied for the Masters in Philosophy and I won a few awards for that. And then I won an AHRC scholarship for my PhD at Jesus College in Cambridge. And this PhD was called Making Sense, and it was all about how art helped me and helped us as human beings make sense of ourselves and the world.
So did that topic come directly from your experience? Because sometimes when you get funding for research for PhDs and masters, it's because there's another academic studying that and you're in their group of people studying that theme. Was this a theme that you were able to choose yourself?
It was just me. It hadn't been done before. It was innovative because at Cambridge, they don't allow you to do anything that isn't entirely new.
Okay. Obviously, other universities work somewhat differently when it comes to doing PhDs, particularly if they're more applied. They often you'll get somebody who's got funding to study fungi in a particular agricultural context, for instance, and you'll be doing bits of work around that and then taking that to the next level of innovation.
Just to quantify, new has to be a new point of view or a new angle or a new piece of data or a new analysis on a certain point. So that point that you're looking at might be ancient and as old as anything, but you have to have a completely different viewpoint on it.
Yeah, because you're adding to the body of knowledge.
Exactly,
Yeah. And all universities work that way, but sometimes the PhD funding comes with a focus that's already preset. And that's why I was asking that question, because making sense is obviously if you had two words that represented you through your life, making sense would probably be up there amongst the top two words you choose, really, wouldn't they? Yeah. So tell us a bit about that PhD.
Well, my time at the Ivory Tower in Cambridge was a huge privilege and extraordinary to be surrounded by such brilliant minds and pure thought, you know, upheld. It was very precious. But at the time, I was very unwell. I was in hospital, Addenbrookes Hospital or Fulbourne Hospital. Fulbourne is the local mental asylum in Cambridge. It's ancient and they have a cemetery. It's great. You know, sorry, it's not even funny. It's not funny at all.
It's so extreme. It's almost funny, actually, isn't it? You have to laugh at it. And I suppose laughter's a coping mechanism as well, in a way, isn't it? We often laugh our way out of trouble. So there you are in a mental asylum with a cemetery right outside the door.
Yeah, they found me very complex because often I was not thin enough to qualify for the eating disorder unit, because in the NHS, to get treatment, to qualify for treatment as an EDU, you have to be on death's door for malnutrition. But I was very, very unwell mentally, seeing sort of hallucinations and self-harming and deeply disturbed. They realised that unless they locked me up somewhere, that I would take my own life. So they just chucked me down the loony bin where the other patients and I would be sort of competing about how many. It's really unwell atmosphere, just really, really just sort of destructive atmosphere. And then, of course, I would stop eating and drinking. So then I would qualify for the EDU. So I'd be chucked in the EDU eventually. And the EDU is the eating disorder unit, and that's in Addenbrookes Hospital. And I was there as a patient about 6 or 7 admissions, or maybe 8 admissions there over the years. And during my PhD, I was in hospital for about 6 or 9 months. My college in Cambridge, they were really kind to me. The chaplain used to come and visit me. He was so kind. And my supervisor, who was helping me with my thesis, he used to come visit me. And they all said to me, "Don't worry, Lorna, your studies can wait for you until you are well." And I found it very difficult. I felt so guilty trying to be in treatment. I didn't think I deserved treatment. I didn't think I deserved any help. I thought I wasn't, didn't even think I was ill. I just thought I just had these voices telling me to destroy myself. And I didn't understand what was going on. I had a hyperactive brain and they sedated me, but that didn't work. Couldn't sleep. Definitely couldn't eat. I was force-fed. PhD was incredible, but I was very unwell for all of it, really. I don't quite know how I managed to finish, but in the end, I finished it in 2.5 years. And then I somehow got a job as a lecturer in Paris at the Sorbonne. I shouldn't have taken that job because I was desperately unwell, but I took it and I moved to Paris. And this is before I graduated. So I finished my PhD, but I hadn't graduated yet, because you have to have a Viva examination where you have an interview, basically. And they had to organise that with these amazing people from all over the world who would come and talk to me about my thesis. So they had to organise that. In the meantime, I went to Paris to teach at the Sorbonne, which was a complete nightmare. It wasn't the fault of the university, which obviously is very prestigious and all that. It was that I was physically totally malnourished, so I couldn't physically sustain myself. Mentally, I was very unstable. And I was in a really bad place. My manager one day took me aside, gave me 50 euros and said, "Go to hospital in a taxi now." So I left the Sorbonne and I was completely out of it at this point. And I took myself somehow, I don't know how I got to a hospital, but then they sectioned me so I couldn't leave. This is in Paris, the outskirts of Paris. And they locked me up in an ancient lunatic asylum called Esquihol, and it doesn't exist anymore. Thank goodness. I was there and they just put me away and did some horrible, horrible things happened. And then I was released and I went back to Addenbrookes Hospital because I'd been there before. So I thought maybe it'd be easier to be in hospital in Cambridge than in Paris. But unfortunately, the team, they let me go back to France. I discharged myself because I was very unwilling to have treatment. It's really complex, all of this, really complex. I'm very unwell. I don't understand what's going on. No one's helping me. I'm just becoming more and more ill. I'm not with it, you know, so moving around. Anyway, I went back to Paris and was sectioned again, went straight back to the lunatic asylum on the outskirts of Paris. And you know, tied to a bed eventually in a padded cell, and unmentionable things happened. And then at that point, I thought to myself, had a clear thought, which is good. The clear thought was, it can't get any worse. And then I realised, in this clear thought I was having, it can only get better. And that's a positive statement. I can't get any worse because it can only get better. And then I thought, right, I'm a prisoner. I was a prisoner, basically. And I thought, if I'm a prisoner, I can have a phone call. You know, prisoners are allowed a phone call. So I screamed because I was on my own in this white padded cell tied to a bed, and I screamed, and they came and they said, what do you want? You know, in French. I can't remember what that is in French.
Qu'est-ce que vous voulez?
Yeah, that's it. Téléphone! Anyway, I rang my parents, who I had been estranged from for many years. My dad answered the phone and I said, it's Lorna. I'm really sorry. I love you. I need you. And my parents drove out to this hospital in Paris. And then I went to court to get off my section. And they said the only way that they would let me off my section would be if I promised to go straight to hospital in England or in Cambridge, where I was before. My parents drove me to Cambridge from Paris, from this hospital. And eventually I was back in Addenbrookes, you know, which wasn't a great deal because it was a pretty bad hospital, Addenbrookes. In this case, in my example, it's not necessarily bad, but in my example, it was bad. But it's better, a lot better than in Cambridge. And in fact, if I remember rightly, they didn't take me straight to Addenbrookes because there was no beds in the EDU. So they sent me back to Fulbourne with the cemetery. And that was great.
Possibly better than Paris. Who knows?
Exactly. Anything would be better than Paris. Anyway, long story short, then I graduated from my PhD whilst I was in a wheelchair. I was sat unwell. I couldn't walk. And then my PhD was published, a book which is called Making Sense, Art, Practice and Transformative Therapeutics. And the great thing about my PhD was I was wavering, really, because I had to prove that it made sense. You know, would art save me? As my argument in the PhD and in the book was that, you know, art can help me make sense of myself and the world and ultimately save me and set me free. But at this point, it wasn't working.
Well, there's often a point in a PhD where you just feel totally lost and it's not working. So in that sense, that's a fairly normal journey. But in your sense, it was quite an abnormal experience because so much was hanging on it, wasn't it? This has to work because it has to save me. It's an extreme.
It is extreme.
If anything, Lorna, I know about you. You're a person who's gone through extremes and uses extremes to push against to move forward.
Yeah. Well, it did work. It does work. I know it works. My PhD and my other books, my stories that I write are all about how art sets me free. I enact that every day of my life. But at this point in my life, when I was in hospital and graduating in my wheelchair, you know, because I couldn't move, I thought to myself, this is a complete fraud.
Imposter syndrome is something that...
That's it.
...is really challenging. And quite ironic, because I've just done a workshop on imposter syndrome for careers advisors, and the stats say that 7 out of 10 people will experience at least one episode of imposter syndrome in their life. And it's particularly prevalent in high-achieving individuals and slightly more prevalent in high-achieving females. So I hope that gives you a sense of, without wishing to take anything away from your extraordinary achievements, a sense of normality in the space that you were in.
Mm.
Because when you're up with the very brightest and the very best, and you're competitive and you want to achieve, the other flip side dynamic is, will I fail? How will that feel? I can't do that. But I wonder how much of that comes back to the brain injury and wanting to prove against the odds that Lorna was back and Lorna could do things and succeed.
I think immediately after my head injury, I was overwhelmed by a feeling of failure and everything had been taken away from me. I had nothing left. It was a blank canvas, but it was a bad blank canvas. The blank canvas later on became an opportunity to be creative and life affirming. But immediately after the brain injury, it was like, I have nothing. I am nothing. I am a complete and utter failure. And I can never get out of this hole. But later on, when I was in Cambridge, I think it was also, I mean, partially a perfectionism, which isn't always healthy. And trying to prove myself. I mean, the whole time trying to find my voice, trying to find my identity, trying to make a mark. And at the time I was applying for research fellowships in Cambridge and Oxford and jobs around Paris and France and the world. I wanted to do a postdoc in Canada, and I had all these ideas, you know. And when you're surrounded by these brilliant minds who are all doing incredible things at, you know, Harvard and Yale and all this stuff, you kind of get sucked in, and it's like, okay, that's what I should be doing. I should be like at the university as a professor and Professor Collins, you know, all that. But it didn't work out quite like that.
But the power of should is a mighty power, and so is the power of perfectionism, which also sits within that imposter syndrome realm. It's one of the key things, along with achievement and so forth. So give yourself a break about imposter syndrome, I think, because if you just, anybody listening to this and anybody who reads and sees anything you've done will just go, flipping heck, not only has she done stuff, she survived, she's actually done some monumental stuff.
I have hardly even started, you know.
I know you've hardly even started, and that's what we're going to go on to explore now, because that's what's so exciting about your journey, that despite all of this stuff and because of all of this stuff, the story just gets better and it gets more compelling. And Lorna, on that quest for self and finding that voice, quite clearly, that creativity that you explored in the PhD was clearly at the heart of your recovery and who you are. Was that really the first time doing that PhD that you saw its power?
No, it was there from the word go after my head injury. Every psychiatric admission, every hospital admission, I would be using art to express myself and to find a way through the head within, you know. So the only reason I was able to do my PhD was because I knew it worked, because art had saved me for so many years. Art was medicine. Art is medicine. Social prescribing is a very new thing in medicine, but it's about how using things that help you feel well and do well and be well, using that as a form of medication rather than relying on drugs, you know. So art has been essential to me. So my PhD was basically, I knew it was going to work, and I knew it was innovative and brand new because no one had ever done it before, in the way that I had in my recovery.
Did art ever give you a sense of control, which is often at the heart of eating disorders, isn't it? That's one of the key issues around eating disorders, from my understanding.
The art is not about control, it's about letting go of control.
So it's the opposite.
So you just be free in the moment. It's the opposite, yeah.
Yeah, so the eating disorder is about control, art is about freedom and expression.
Eating disorder is partially about control. For me, it was about trying to control something when I had lost control of everything.
Okay.
But it's not just about control, but that's part of it. Art for me is a way of breaking free from everything that tries to control me or pin me down.
Is there a sense when you're in that phase of art, you're in that state of what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi calls flow, where you have no sense of self and ego, and it's just that creativity that's taking you somewhere? So there's loss of sense of self, but in a good way.
I'm not sure about the self and the ego, because I'm not a psychoanalyst, but I know when I am creative, there is definitely a flow, and there is definitely a moment of focus in which I am totally at one with my materials and what I'm doing, and there are no thoughts.
Yeah, flow, definitely.
It just happens.
Yeah, that's exactly what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi talks about, and that sense of so focused that everything else disappears. So time walks, goes incredibly fast or slow, no sense of self, total absorption in what you're doing.
Mm.
So this sense of flow that gives expression, and using that as something good that's come out of all of the difficult stuff in a way that teaches others as well. You take that forward as a theme, don't you? That sense of art and how that can help people. And at a time when you're still facing lots of mental health challenges yourself, you're still highly functioning, and you decide it's time to give to others and you do some volunteering.
Yes. So when I was in hospital, my final admission, which was in Oxford in 2017-18, I realised that I could make something out of my life using my own experiences of being unwell and recovering. I realized I could make a difference in the world by sharing my own experiences of being unwell and my experiences of getting better and recovery, and sharing the things that helped me could maybe help other people. And I knew that what helped and what helps me so much is being creative and using the arts. So I thought maybe I could try and volunteer, do some work for mental health charities. using my lived experience. And lived experience became a big thing for me. So I worked at my local mine, so the Buckinghamshire Mine, which is a mental health charity. And I worked with Time to Change, which is a subset of Mind. And I talked to people about my experiences, and I helped other people express their own experiences and be creative using the arts and find ways of coping in the community.
Was that purely UK? Does what you do work with people with a European outlook? Or is that something that you've experienced with other cultures as well?
I've mostly worked in the UK, but I have also worked in India and Cambodia and America doing creative things. Yeah.
And helping people find a way forward and a voice and self-expression, no doubt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's not just art in the sense of drawing and so forth, is it? I introduced you at the start as a filmmaker, and we haven't really talked about that yet. Mm.
Well, film is a medium that I use to tell stories. I've made films about my illness, about the eating disorder, about psychosis, about hallucinations, and about recovery. And I use film as a lens to open a visage of my mind. I've also made one documentary about the Adivasis, the indigenous people of India. I like film because you can make a sequence of shots and images that tell a story about what you want to say. And I find it's useful because people can watch a film. So you have, say, 5-10 minutes. My films are always quite short. Like, they have 5-10 minutes to form an argument and to present a picture and draw people in. And done analog film, so like 16 millimeter film. I've done a film and put 100 meters of film reel on the ground and painted on it and then rolled it up and played it in a steam bag, a projector, to see what it looks like. And so I do kind of wacky things like that. But then I just like go and do documentaries about different communities. And at the moment, I'm making a film called Hallucinosis, which is a working title, about my hallucinations, which is about subjectivity and reality. You know, how can anyone show someone else what they're seeing with when the experience isn't mutual? Anyway, that's what I'm looking at.
That's really interesting. My mother had a stroke, and I went to visit her on the ward one day, and I walked in and said, "Hi, Mum, how are you doing?" And she said, "I had a visitor today." I was expecting her to say her mate Jane had popped in to say hello from the town. It wasn't. She said, "I had a visitor, an amphibian." I went, "Oh, yes. How was that? Tell me about that then." She said, "Well, about so high," and she pointed about the height of the foot of the bed. "He was green. He was quite chunky." I said, "Oh, did you have a good conversation?" She said, "I had a great conversation." She said, "I asked him what he was doing here, and he told me, and then I said to him to go away, and he did." And yet there was no green frog. Amphibian, obviously, clearly on a ward in a British hospital. Yeah. Anyway, nobody was dressed up as one. So clearly her mind after a stroke had started to create hallucinations. And that's common in lots of conditions as well, isn't it? Lots of eye conditions and sometimes in things like Parkinson's and so forth. How do you cope with them?
I am creative. That's how I cope. So I'm wandering around on the farm where I live. And this morning I saw a badger. Okay, so the badger is... It was a real badger. And then the badger, which I saw, was run over by a car and his eyeballs popped out and then they became stars. And then the stars flew to the moon. And then on the moon, there was all these things happening inside the vision that I'm seeing. So there's a real badger and then it becomes all these other things. So what do? I immediately do some reality checking with my dog. So I look at Foxy and she definitely saw the badger. She did not see the badger be run over and turned into all these other things that I saw. So yeah, I can check what's real and what's my real. And they're two different things. I also am creative, so I write it down and I have a list of many, many stories. And then they become books. And then I paint or draw, and I am creative, so I have all sorts of manners of expression, and that helps an awful lot.
Is there any sense of those hallucinations being like a warning sign for you for something?
Yes, definitely. Sometimes. I mean, the ones at the moment are quite playful, so I'm not too worried. It's okay. I'm fine. But they can be very much warning signals. As I was saying before, I was working at Mind and Time to Change, and then I went back into academia because I quite missed doing academic stuff. And I was a research fellow at University College London. I can't really remember how I got that job, but I somehow did. And then I started working as a lecturer in my dream course. And it was like my dream job. The idea of Professor Lorna came back. It's like, ooh, maybe, you know. But then I suddenly started like hallucinating the really violent scenes and like going on the tube commuting a man would attack me in awful ways. And then I just couldn't cope with it. I'm not saying it was the job's fault, because the job was amazing, but I realised that there was no space for me to be creative in that job, that the pressure of working in academia, the hard work, the workload itself was immense. And there was no opportunity for me to express myself or to just have a moment to just reflect and create something about my experiences. There's no opportunity for me to be true to my experiences. There was just the work, the students and colleagues and the system. And I realised that I don't actually fit inside systems at all. And my hallucinations were basically like, Lorna, you're going to die, you know. And I was like, oh, hang on. And I did stop for a minute. I was forced to stop for a minute. I realised I'm in the wrong career.
I wonder, it sounds like your hallucinations are almost like your guardian angels.
They're my beacons. They're beacons.
That's your way of your brain going, where some of us might have what I call the parrot of doubt going, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure this is the right direction? Or that inner voice, more particularly that inner voice. Yours is a visual inner voice in a way, isn't it, that goes, oh, hang on a minute, alarm bells are ringing. And I'm not at all surprised. There was a smile on my face when you said about, I don't fit in systems, because you'd had to fit in systems so much for the best part of 20 years in mental health situations, in academia, which is a whole strict system in itself, with cycles and expectations and, as you say, huge workloads. And actually, PhDs often break a lot of people. I used to work as a careers advisor at my local university, and people would come and just go, I don't know where I am. I'm totally lost. I'm confused. Why am I doing this? Where is it taking me? Because it's such a challenging experience. And, you know, you think about even the Viva that you had to go through. You have to defend your PhD. It's a very combative environment in the way that people talk and the expectations and high levels of research and all the rest of it. So I'm not at all surprised that there was part of you went, for goodness sake, I'm fed up with systems and being locked in. And of course, you'd already gone and done another degree by then, hadn't you? Done a fine arts degree.
I did MA in fine art only because I wanted to teach art. I also did a PG cert in learning and teaching higher education to qualify as a teacher, an academic teacher in a university. But I realised I did not want to teach anything but art, moving closer to art. And the only way I could teach art was to do an MA in fine art. So I had to do yet another qualification. I did not enjoy doing that degree at all. It really upset me because I was a painter at the time and they were so rude about my paintings that I didn't paint for 4 years afterwards. I was totally traumatized by the art degree, even though it was great in the end. Going to art school is hardcore, you know. They'd like to rip you to pieces.
And that is part of the academic process, isn't it? It's the pulling apart, retraining and putting back together again. And many a person's been thrown off track by that process. Your art, from an academic perspective, seems to have served its purpose in a way. But the joy that you get from using art is the fuel that keeps you going, I think, really clearly and helps you express who you are and get that voice out. So we're at the stage now, University College London, postdoc research fellow and lecturer, recognition that, flipping it, what am I doing here? Let me out of here. And that takes us to 2020 and that new decade. Mm. 2020 seems to have been a period that your life has stabilised because you haven't been in hospital for a while, but you get the warning sign and you go, academia, get me out of here. I think a significant moment for you personally in terms of your own age as well.
Yes, in 2021, I was 40. Oh my God, I'm actually old.
No, you're not. You've got loads in front of you.
You know what? The 40, this is a bit corny, you know, but actually, I honestly feel this is the beginning of my true life. Being 40, in my 40s. I'm 41 now, I think. Am I 41? I've kind of stopped counting. I think I'm 41. What year is it?
23.
Yes, I think it's... Yeah, exactly. That I can't remember. But you know what? This is it. I've just beginning now and I feel like I'm finally on the right path.
Do you know, it's funny you should say that. There's gallons of evidence that show, or should I say litres of evidence that show that people often change career or finally get a sense of what they're here for round about the 40 mark. It's a known period of career. I changed career at 39 myself, so I totally understand from a lived experience again. Mm. But the statistics and the research show that lots of people change career round about then or suddenly go, I know why I'm here. When you look back on your career up until that point, what do you think were the most useful lessons and insights that you gained from all of it? Apart from, I don't like systems and I want freedom.
I think a combination of being creative is, has been absolutely crucial throughout all of the systemic academic work I've done, because being creative allows you to have a novel viewpoint, and that's essential. I think persistence is really important, because you have to keep going whatever happens. You have to just keep going, and that takes a lot of strength and belief, really. But persistence, I've always been persistent, because you get a lot of no's and negations and rejections in life, but just keep plugging on, you know, and eventually it'll work out. And that belief that eventually it will work out has been crucial for me. I mean, it's partially self-belief, but I've been dwarfed by self-negation and upset about myself and not really believing in myself. But I've carried on despite that. And it is important to keep carrying on, even if you don't think you're capable of doing something, because you can't do something unless you try. And patience, I'm not at all patient. I don't know why I said that. I'm totally impatient. I'm really, really impatient. I don't think that's helped me at all. So, no.
So maybe impatient, but persistent, which gets you to the same place. And what you've just talked about there really is a great example of a growth mindset. I haven't learnt yet. It hasn't worked yet, but I can keep learning through the experiments as I go.
Yeah. Also, another one, fake it to make it. It's brilliant.
Absolutely.
If you can't do something, pretend. Pretend you can do it until you can.
And as soon as you do that, of course, the belief system changes, which is why you are able to make it, because you now don't have this sense of I can't do it. It gets you past the blocks that we put in front of ourselves. So you realise that systems are not for you, 2020, start to make changes, and then you take a big step into where you are now.
Yeah, so I had a moment where I decided that I was going to resign from my dream job as a lecturer in creative health at University College London. I decided that I didn't want to write papers or books that no one was going to read, that no one was going to publish, that no one could afford. I wanted to write pet stories that people would laugh at and enjoy reading, like I'd already been writing, because I've been writing copious amounts for years, and painting as well. So I resigned from my job. I got a book published, a book that people want to read. And you might think that's really arrogant of me to say that, but lots of people are reading it. It's very exciting. I'm feeling really excited about this publication. I'm holding up my book. It's a picture of a pink flamingo, and it says Squawk, a book of bird adventures. Now, this is a book written for kids aged between 8 to 12. But you know what? It's any age, really. You can read it to your younger kids, and it's for the whole family. It doesn't matter how old you are. Age is just a number. As I said before, I can't even remember how old I am. But I'm finally writing and painting and being creative and loving life.
And you've given yourself permission to be free from those systems, because you are now self-employed.
I am self-employed, and it's quite a risky moment, because it's like, where'd you get the money from? And it's a bit, yes. But I do workshops and lectures and seminars across the world. I went to New York recently because a film I made was being shown in a big festival, and they paid me to go. I'm doing good things, and it's really exciting. And the world is my oyster, and I've only just hardly begun. Watch this space. Watch out.
I can see, and I'm sure every listener can hear the joy in your voice. It's audible, the joy and the excitement that you're experiencing. In your TEDx talk, How Creativity Revived Me, you talked about a total loss of identity and feeling lost, and there was a sense of not having a voice. How different do you feel now about yourself, your identity, and your future?
I feel my identity is actually, an identity for everyone is about difference. And by that, I mean not necessarily a massive French philosophical argument about post-structuralism, which I could go into, but I won't, don't worry. No, the point is difference. You know, we can become whoever we want to be. We can follow our dreams, and we can have hope. And there is always difference. Things can be different. And I think if you believe that, you can totally move forwards and create whoever you want to be. When I was unwell, I thought that the only thing that existed was my awful darkness and depression, and that the world was a bad, bad place. But now, because I have created so many different opportunities for myself, just using who I am, really, the world is a very open place. It can bring to me anything I want from it. And that might mean, you know, to be totally honest, what I really want is a 6-book deal, an agent, a TV series, a radio series, and all that, you know. And it's like, is that any of that going to happen? I doubt it. Who knows? I doubt it. Probably not. But you know what could happen was today I decided to start playing around with the front cover of my next book. And I've got the front cover of it in my head now. And that makes me very happy. It's called To Wit To Woo, A Book of Bird Adventures. And just even making a visualization of my future, my next book, makes me very happy. And that happiness and that joy and that energy can push me to do great things.
Indeed it can, Lorna. And I have no doubt that there are many more great things to come. You've taken us on a fascinating journey through academia, ill health. Your brilliant mind has been clear all the way through that, and I'd like you to accept that gift rather than reject it. You've found a sense of identity. You've got a voice. You help others find their voice through creativity and now through the stories you're telling. There's clearly no doubt that you are an author and a writer because you've done it for years in a different context. Now you're doing it in a context that brings you deep pleasure and happiness and the same to other people. Before we finish today, there's a last question I always ask guests. Is there a theme tune or a quote or a video or something that keeps you going? You've talked about persistence and that grit to keep on going. I wonder if there is an echo of falling off horses and getting back on again in that, right back to the start of your journey. But is there something that you always go to that is something that warms you when you need it?
Yes. When I was studying French philosophy, I came across a German philosopher called Herbert Marcuse, who is in the Frankfurt School, a radical critique of capitalists in German thought. He said, art cannot change the world, but it can contribute to changing the consciousness and drives of the men and women who could change the world. And that's what we're all doing, isn't it? Changing the world.
And that's certainly what you've done. And no wonder that quote resonates with you, because that's been your story to date. And I wish you every success with what's coming. I will be watching with interest. Lorna Collins, thank you ever so much today for your time and sharing your story so freely.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Often we make decisions to move in a certain direction because we've been given opportunities or nudged by others. We know deep down if what we're doing is right. We all have a voice, that quiet voice that knows what's good for us, the voice within which expresses disquiet. The trick is to listen to that voice, to trust it, and to take our courage in both hands so we can move in the direction of something new which calls to us. As the saying goes, we can't be what we can't see until something in someone else's story inspires us to take the next step, to try something new, to adventure. If this episode has helped you to do just that, to change your story in some way, then please share it and the show notes that go with it on your social media channels so it can help others you know too to escape from a job they hate and create a career they love. See you here next time, where we'll be hearing another inspirational guest story that will help you to continue to change your story for the better.